Hello, welcome to another edition of MotoGPOD, the podcast about motorcycle road racing. Today is Monday, the 19th of September, and I'm a little bit late getting my Motegi Rus report up. I wanted to post it late Sunday night so that it would be ready Monday morning for all the international listeners and all that, but I had an reserved dual weekend, and I just ran out of time Sunday night. I apologize for that. So I'm a little bit late, but at least we're up on Monday morning Pacific time, which is good. I'm going to do my qualifying and race reports for Motegi, and followed by an interesting listener email question that I received from Jennifer Haynes. I normally try to cover the listener emails at the top of the show, but I really can't answer Jennifer's question without kind of spoiling the race, so it's going to come at the end of the podcast. I got a good suggestion last week from John Garza to put the times in the show notes or into the intro of the podcast when I do a situation like that where there's a race report and it followed by something else, so that way you could skip the race report if you didn't want to have a spoiler. But it doesn't really can fit this situation because answering this question is going to spoil the race, so I'm not even going to bother sort of figuring out the time and doing all that. I will do it next time that I have two race reports in one podcast so that you can, you know, kind of skip ahead if you want to hear that second race report without sort of spoiling the race that the first one is about. Okay, thanks also to all of the other listeners that sent in emails this past week. I really appreciate it. I always do. Keep them coming in to MotoGPOD@MotoGPOD.com. Really like the suggestions. It's always great to get suggestions for the show, and I like questions, and the compliments are always great to hear as well. Even though I don't typically read them out on the podcast, I kind of think it's sort of a vanity fest if I just sit here and read a whole bunch of emails that say, you know, I love your podcast, it's really great, and that sort of thing. But I do like getting them. You know, it's a big ego boost. I appreciate it, so thanks a lot. And then also, searching in the podcast directories lately, it looks like to me that MotoGPOD is still the only game in town as far as a motorcycle road racing podcast is concerned, and that actually surprises me a little, because there's at least four pretty good podcasts dedicated to Formula One, and actually I think there's a couple more that seriously cover Formula One, and you know, everybody knows that MotoGP is so much more exciting than Formula One, so it's a little bit of a surprise that nobody else has run with it, but I guess I'll just enjoy having no competition on the podcasting while it lasts, and hopefully I keep making the podcast good enough that you guys keep coming back and listening to it. Like I say, I really do appreciate it. It turns out that Shane Byrne, the former Team KR rider that lost his ride because of the troubles that Team KR is having with KTM engines and sponsorship and money, it turns out that Shane Byrne got a call from Camel Honda team boss Sito Pons offering him a ride on the Honda RC211V to replace the injured Troy Bayliss. This is a fantastic opportunity for Shaky. It's a real opportunity for him to show his skills on a truly competitive machine. He's going to ride for Camel Honda for at least the next two races here at Sepang and Doha in Qatar. Byrne knows Sepang pretty well because he's tested there a few times, but he's never been to Qatar, so hopefully he can get on the track and get his track knowledge down, you know, early on in those practice sessions and get accustomed to the motorcycle. I'm not sure if he's going to get any testing time at all before the official test at Malaysia. I don't think so. So he'll be learning a new motorcycle and one really unfamiliar track and one track that he's, you know, moderately familiar with. At least he's starting out with Sepang where he's been before, so he'll only have to really worry about the motorcycle. It's going to be really interesting to see how that works out, and you know, best of luck, Shaky. I hope you do really well, and Troy, I hope that your recovery's progressing nicely, and we'll see how that turns out. Okay, let's move on to our Motegi qualifying report. Loris Capirossi demonstrated why Ducati was so keen to secure a recent contract renewal with him for next season, because with setting a stunning lap time in the qualifying session for the Grand Prix of Japan at Motegi, he starts the 12th round of the MotoGP World Championship from pole position, thanks to his record-setting time of 1 minute 46.363 seconds. It's almost half a second quicker than closest challenger John Hopkins on his Suzuki with a time of 146.861. Interestingly, Capirossi and Hopkins are both on Bridgestone tires, which usually seem to be inferior to the Michelins, but there's something about Motegi, perhaps that really smooth surface or the lack of time they're spending in turns, deep into turns, that really suits those Bridgestones. Last year, Makoto Tomata, who was riding on Bridgestones for the entire season last year on his Honda, qualified on pole and then went on to win the race at Motegi. And Hopkins also qualified second on the grid and might have done fairly well in the race if he hadn't been taken out of the entire race in the very first corner along with five other riders. For this race, Hopkins was quoted as saying, "If I can get through turn one, I'm going to have a hell of a race," which I thought was kind of pretty funny considering that he has crashed out on the first lap at the last 2 years. First lap on turn one, Motegi. I think that's indicative of Hopkins' kind of good attitude, and that he can sort of make light of that, and he must be feeling some pressure, that's for sure, on that. Marco Melandri was the top Michelin and top Honda qualifier, with the final front row spot in third place, setting a time of 1 minute 46.867 seconds, which is just 6 thousandths off of Hopkins' pace. Tomada showed signs of a return to his best form after a difficult season, challenging for pole before dropping to fourth place as Caparossi raised the stakes in the final moments of the session. Tomada ended up with a time of 1:47.043. He's joined on the second row by bearded warrior Max Biaggi and Nicky Hayden, with times of 1:47.089 for Biaggi and 1:47.166 for Hayden. Max is quoted as saying, "We're definitely coming better, and it is good to be starting higher up the grid than usual. We still have a long way to go to get to the front, but the second row is better than we have had for much of the season." Which, kind of ouch, that you sort of take that quote out of context, and it makes for a pretty cheesy headline, like I saw somewhere on the internet. Sete Gibernau started from the third row in seventh position with a time of 1:47.168, 2 thousandths of a second off of Hayden. Kenny Roberts, next non-Honda rider on his second Suzuki motorcycle there, starts from 8th position with a time of 1:47.257. Next to him on row 3, Carlos Checa on the second Ducati, 9th fastest with a time of 1:47.323. Alex Barros on the first of the Camel Hondas, he's on the front, the 4th row in 10th spot with a time of 1:47.562. And if you've been paying attention to this qualifying report, you'll notice that there's one name that I very conspicuously have not yet mentioned. Valentino Rossi missed out on completing his final qualifying lap as he arrived at the finish line just 3 seconds after this checkered flag was waved to end the qualifying session. Rossi had pitted for a last-gasp tire change to try to get out a really fast lap, and he just couldn't quite cross the finish line before that checkered flag went down, and he was done. That meant that reigning world champion and hoping to lock up the 2005 championship series here at Motegi, Rossi will start his Yamaha from the middle of the fourth row in 11th spot. This is his worst qualifying performance since being sent to the back of the grid at Qatar in 2004. Rossi's official qualifying time was 1:47.563, only 1 thousandth of a second behind Barros. Alex Hoffman had the best time for a Kawasaki rider with a 1:47.594, good enough for 12th on the grid. Hoffman said, "My qualifying position is not what I was looking for at Kawasaki's home race, but then I haven't been as close to Valentino Rossi on the grid before. It's not easy for us. We're still giving away too much top speed to our rivals, so we'll just have to fight with what we have at the moment." And I have to tend to wonder if he asked Valet for his autograph when he was that close to him on the grid there or what. He seemed kind of excited about it. Rossi's teammate Colin Edwards had an even more disappointing day as he struggled to 13th place and a fifth row start on a time of 1:47.678. Not a really good qualifying session for the Galwa Yamaha team. Shinya Nakano, who in the qualifying session had 20 minutes remaining in the session, he suffered a smoky engine failure on his Kawasaki. He could not improve his time after switching to a spare machine and slipped down to 14th as a result, with an eventual time of 1:47.787. Earlier in the session, he had looked pretty good and was hoping to be up in at least the top two rows, I think. Nakano finished third last year and said, "I'm very upset about this situation. It is very difficult to overtake here, and to be starting on the fifth row makes my job tomorrow all the more difficult." So, replacement rider Toru Ukawa, riding for the injured Troy Bayliss on the second Camel Honda machine, turned in a fairly disappointing time of 1:48.194, 0.4 behind Nakano, to earn 15th on the grid. He didn't qualify very well at Motegi last year, so it might just be something about the circuit for him. I'm not 100% sure. Robbie Rolfo on the Dantin Satellite Team Ducati rode a 1:48.733 to qualify 16th, followed by Tony Elias on the first of the Fortuna Yamahas, with a 1:48.861 for 17th. 18th on the grid, with a time of 1:49.734, which is nearly 0.9 of a second slower than Elias. This goes to wildcard rider Naoki Matsudo, appearing in his home GP on the Moriwaki bike. This is only the second time this year that we've seen that Honda-powered Moriwaki racing bike, and was kind of interesting to see what kind of performance we're going to see out of them in the race. I'm sure they're hoping to do as well as they possibly can in their home Grand Prix. Ruben Chouse on the other Fortuna Yamaha is the first rider on the 7th row in 19th position with a dismal 149.969. I'm not 100% sure what happened to Chouse there, why his qualifying time's just so far down. He's followed by the two WCM bikes in 20th and 21st on the grid, with Franco Battiani in a rare occurrence out-qualifying his teammate James Ellison by 0.07 of a second. Battiani had a 151.902 and Ellison had a 151.972, putting them about 5.5 seconds off the pole setting time. I believe Ellison may have been injured during the qualifying session. I'm not, without good coverage that, you know, we didn't get television coverage of the qualifying sessions and everything, but I saw something about Ellison being injured, and I wasn't 100% sure if there's something that happened before the qualifying session or during the qualifying session or what, but that may explain why Ellison, who typically out-qualifies Battiani, came in behind him. Okay, here's where we talk about the race. So if you haven't yet watched it, the race, and you're planning to watch it on MotoGP.com, or if you recorded it or whatever, and you don't want any spoilers, now is the time for you to turn off the podcast. I'm going to start talking about results here right about now, so last chance to turn it off. Okay, Caparossi made a cautious start from pole position, chasing early leader Marco Melandri over the opening laps before being joined by Max Biaggi. Rossi, meanwhile, made excellent progress from 11th on the grid, moving up to 5th within 2 laps with some very aggressive riding. By the time that Rossi caught the leading 3 riders on the 4th lap, Melandri had been sent back to 3rd place after holding off Biaggi and Caparossi for a little bit, but neither of them could really take advantage and break away as they diced with each other for the lead numerous times, each running a tad wide on more than one occasion, so that leading trio was fairly tight, and Rossi managed to cap the opponent about the 4th or 5th lap. Then on lap 13, in a rare mistake, Rossi collided with Melandri into turn 10, and he sent both riders tumbling into the gravel. The only shots they had of this incident on the TV coverage were on boards, so it was tough to get a really good angle on exactly what happened. Rossi was coming up on the inside of Melandri, and it looked to me like Melandri was holding his line pretty much perfectly, and Rossi just kind of didn't tip it in soon enough, and it really looked like Rossi had made the serious mistake here, which, seeing as he was the passing rider, is kind of indicative that's the normal way it works. You know, if you're being passed, you hold your line. If you're the passing rider, you know, if you crash into the back of somebody, it's almost always your fault. Both riders slid across the track into the gravel trap, with Rossi jumping up immediately, obviously unhurt, and he ran over to check on Melandri, who had stayed down and looked like he was in great pain. I hope also that Rossi took the opportunity to tell Melandri that he was sorry about it, because I'm not sure how anyone can say anything other than that the crash was clearly Rossi's fault. However, after the race, Rossi had this to say about it. "I knew it would be a risk to try and overtake, and I expected Loris to pass Max in the final few laps. I knew I could be world champion with 4th place, so I decided to just wait and do my race. Then Marco made a small mistake, and suddenly I was behind him," which, yeah, he did. Marco kind of zipped off the track onto the into the dirt for just a split second. It didn't really wobble the bike, but it did slow him down a tiny bit, and that caught Rossi up a bit. It was the first time that he followed him into turn 10, and we took completely different lines. Melandri went to the outside of the track to cut across and get good acceleration out of the corner, but I went to the inside to run wider on the exit. For the first 50 meters of braking, we were at exactly the same speed, so there was no warning, but he was able to stop the bike much harder than me, and I couldn't avoid him. You can't see it very well on television, but I wasn't even trying to pass him. It was just one of those things. I apologized to Marco, and he said, it happens. So now I'm very concerned for him, and I just hope that he is okay. So Rossi didn't quite full-on say, it was my fault. But he's kind of clearly sort of saying that. It sort of sounded one time like, you know, he was blaming Melandri at one of the post-interviews, but I don't think that was the case. He, you know, I think Rossi knows. Gawa's Yamaha team director David Brivio added, "Our first concern is for Marco Melandri. We are not sure of his injuries just yet, but we hope it is not serious, and I wish him well on behalf of the whole team. There was a protest against Valentino put forward by Honda on behalf of all the Honda MotoGP teams, but Race Direction has judged this unfounded. As far as the championship is concerned, it's a pity that we couldn't finish it off here, and for Valentino, it is a shame that his run of podiums has been interrupted. All we can do is try to make up for it by taking the points back next time," which is, this is true. Valentino was set to break Wayne Rainey's podium record this race, and unfortunately missed out on that. Interestingly, it We'll have to see if we can get more information on this or get some better angles on the whole incident or to see a little bit more about that, about what happened. MotoGP.com says that Melandri sustained contusion and compound wound of the right heel, whatever that means, and fractures and serious injuries were ruled out, but he was taken to the hospital for further medical checks and so forth. Okay, back to the race. Biaggi was now leading Caparossi. The pair were left alone at the front with a good-sized gap back to Tomata, who was now in third. Caparossi stalked Biaggi for the next six laps before making his move in the final few laps of the race and opening up an advantage of 1.4 seconds, including there was a couple of laps where he took off more than half a second on Biaggi in a single lap, opening up his gap. This is probably due to tire wear. Caparossi was using a medium rear with Bridgestone, while Biaggi had a soft rear Michelin. And Biaggi's rear may have been going off a little bit by this point in the race, and that was allowing Caparex to use that sort of monster grunt that Ducati V4 is famous for to take a clear, resounding victory there. This is Ducati's first win of the season, and the first for tire manufacturer Bridgestone since they won here last year at Motegi with Makoto Tomata. Tomata incidentally crossed the line at his home Grand Prix in a distance third place, almost 15 seconds behind the two leaders. Carlos Checa took the checkered flag in fourth place, 22 seconds down on his victorious teammate. And John Hopkins, who started from the front row of the grid, and he got what initially looked like a really good start, but he lost a few positions going into that first corner, possibly because he's a little bit nervous about that first corner after having crashed there on the first lap, both in 2003 and 2004. Hopper eventually picked up his best ever Grand Prix finish in fifth spot, finishing ahead of Colin Edwards and Nicky Hayden in sixth and seventh. Both of them had fairly disappointing performances, and television coverage of anyone outside the top group was just non-existent, especially after Rossi crashed out and the cameras cut away to show him returning to the pits and team reaction and all that sort of stuff at every possible opportunity. So I'm not sure why Nicky sort of lost so much ground. He kind of just dropped out of the top 10 before the Rossi and Melandri incident and Sete. So, I mean, he must have been quite a ways down. And then after Sete and Rossi and Melandri all crossed out on the same lap, he moved up to like eighth spot or so and eventually finished there in his eighth. And it was a fairly lonely race for him. He had a good gap, you know, between the guy in front of him and the rider behind him. So, and interestingly enough, after Sete Gibernau crashed out, which did happen right before the Rossi incident, after Sete crashed out, they did not show his girlfriend on camera. And I'm wondering if maybe she couldn't make it to Japan, or if the Japanese TV director just decided to do something different than the usual, you know, show Sete's girlfriend shot that they always do after Sete has any kind of problem. Okay, Kenny Roberts took 8th, followed by Tony Elias in 9th, Ruben Chaus in 10th, and then Franco Battiaini finishing last in 11th spot, picking up 5 championship points just through attrition. Only 11th riders finished the usual Motegi crash fest. Morawaki's Matsudo went off on the first lap. Robbie Rolfo and Alex Hoffman went down together on lap 3, Hoffman breaking his ankle, which is almost certainly going to rule him out for the rest of the season. And not sure who or what, you know, the incidents of that crash were, of who, you know, who did what, but they both went down. Yukawa retired 2 laps later with some kind of mechanical problem, just sent him into the pits. Shinya Nakano had a second engine failure for the weekend on lap 9. Spraying what looked like oil and stuff. He got offline real quick, but there was a lot of big smoky oil failure. Gibernau had crashed out on lap 12, and then Melandri, Rossi, and Barros all went down on lap 13, which Barros in a separate incident from Rossi and Melandri's joint effort, and because they were so busy showing you Rossi and Melandri crashing, you kind of didn't really see much of what happened to Barros. Some of the coverage of the race was a little odd. It was almost like there was so many things that they happening that they kept missing opportunities to show you, you know, other things. So, you know, you'd come back halfway through an incident and you'd see the rider sliding across the gravel, but you didn't see why, you know, initially caused the crash. A little disappointing on that. Okay, so after this, this means that the only rider with a mathematical chance at all of halting Rossi's championship charge is Mad Max Biaggi, and he has to score 14 points more than Rossi to prevent him from clinching the title at the next race in Sepang. So for that, you know, for instance, Biaggi would have to win it, and then Rossi would have to come in like fifth, I think, just in order to even come close to getting that 14-point gap. I think that would just about do it. Or, you know, so, yeah, some kind of combination like that. You know, Rossi crashes out, Biaggi finishes high, whatever. Something with 14 points. So it's not looking like that's too likely to happen, to be honest with you. So I'm pretty safe in saying that Rossi's going to clinch the championship next season or next race here at Sepang. There was a complaint against Rossi, which I mentioned earlier here, regarding the incident with Melandri, but it was rejected by race direction. So meaning that, like I said, a top four finish is going to be more than enough, no matter where Biaggi finishes in Malaysia. So all in all, kind of an interesting race, not the most exciting of the year. It sort of turned into a parade a little bit there in the middle, but it certainly did kind of shake things up. You don't see Rossi crash out of races very often at all, so that kind of made things a little interesting. Okay, we're going to cover a listener email now. It's like I said, I would normally do these at the beginning of the show, but with this one, I didn't feel like I could sort of talk about it without kind of spoiling the race, so I wanted to hold it off till the end of the show. Alert MotoGPOD listener Jennifer Haynes sent me an email in which she had this to say. She says, "Hey, just wanted to thank you for putting your passion into a great podcast that I never miss. I have a question for you that might be worthy of the show. Why do so many riders have a problem with Motegi? I would appreciate any insight you might have on this because personally, it's one of my favorites on the PS2. So, well, thank you very much for the nice compliments, Jennifer. Appreciate that. Good luck on the PS2. I assume you got the latest new version of the MotoGP racing. I personally prefer the Xbox version, which is a completely different game, but I don't play either very often because my son is the big Xbox fan, and every now and then I'll go down there and help him with it. Okay, as far as the question, it's a great one, and I'm afraid I don't have much of a really solid answer that I can sort of back up with any kind of technical data beyond just sort of simple opinion. Motegi has a reputation as being not overly challenging in a technical sense, and I really think that has something to do with it. For instance, like Tomata has said, the track is not difficult. There are no secrets, not like Mugello, for instance, and that as long as you can keep your concentration, you'll do okay. So one of two things could come from that. Either riders are tending to underestimate Motegi and sort of not give it the respect and attention and concentration that it deserves, or possibly they just lose concentration because of this sort of non-challenging nature of the circuit. I mean, it could be something that they're getting bored. I don't think it's quite that clear cut with that first stop and go kind of section, and then you've got the fast straight leading into the very imaginatively named 90-degree turn. But it could be something along those lines. Rossi has always had problems here, and he's certainly not alone. And it's not very typical for Rossi to have a track where he just can never quite make it click. Motegi also has a reputation as a track that makes passing difficult. And this is actually probably more of a worthy sort of a reason why so many riders have a shot, is that it might be that when riders do take an opportunity to make a pass, they're really on the ragged edge. That sort of idea would certainly be helped out by Rossi's incident with Melandri, for instance. Rossi was very aggressive in the first several laps of the race, making contact more than once, forcing Hayden quite wide, with a kind of a daring inside pass sort of a thing, and several other extremely close passes. And then we had that whole Melandri incident. And I think that's what it is that now that I think about it, that, you know, when they do have a passing shot, it's like they're so much on the edge. Although that doesn't explain why we have several riders that were sort of crashing out just alone by themselves. You know, Morawaki and Matsuda just went off on turn one. It's like he forgot to turn. So I'm not sure. That's about the best answer that I can come up with. So I know it's a little bit weak. I would like to hear some other opinions. So if any other listeners out there have an opinion on this, send me an email to motogpod@motogpod.com. Let me know your theories about why so many riders have a problem with Motegi, because it's certainly true. Like I said, it's often sort of a crash fest. Okay, that's going to do it for today's podcast, our Motegi race report. Thank you very much for downloading it and listening to it. I appreciate that. And we'll have another show next Friday, which will be our preview show for the Malaysian Grand Prix, which takes place next weekend at Sepang. And hopefully I will be back in the groove after a somewhat chaotic past couple of weeks with my schedule, and I'll be back more on track and have a little bit more time to prep and things like that. I had that audio problem on the last podcast, and I went back and listened to it a little while ago, and it was just, it was awful. But I managed to sort that out and figure out a workaround, so hopefully this one sounds a bit more like they've been sounding a little better, because that one had just horrible noise, and I had to do a very aggressive sort of sound noise gate filter to try to get rid of this background noise, and it just sounded terrible. So, sorry about that on the last podcast, but this one sounds good. Anyways, thanks again for listening. I will talk to you later. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorner Sports SL. The MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorner Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGP OD isn't affiliated with any of them.